The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 285.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is one of my favorite macro thinkers. His name is Luke Grohman. Luke, welcome back to the show, my friend.
Glad to be back, George. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Now, I remember it might have been the last time we spoke or the time prior when we jokingly said the Fed's balance sheet could even get to $10 trillion. Ha 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 ha. We're just laughing and laughing like that was some kind of joke. And here we are. What are we at? 8.5?
Something like that. Yeah. Something like that. Still moving higher.
Yeah. So where do you see it going from here as far as the Fed's balance sheet? And maybe more specifically, this inflation debate. Do you think inflation is transitory or do you think it's something more permanent like we saw in the 1970s?
So I think the balance sheet, ultimately, for a number of different reasons, we're seeing the dollar-centric system as it's been structured since 1971 breaking down in real time. And it was always going to happen. There have been a number of geopolitical and economic reasons that it has accelerated. Most recently, COVID really put the turbocharger on that happening. And so ultimately, as this happens, the Fed will consistently face the same decision over and over at shrinking intervals, which is what we've seen over the last 3 years. And that decision is let the system collapse chaotically or continue to grow their balance sheet to basically bail out the entire system, the entire dollar-centric system, to basically re-inject base money dollars under an over-leveraged system. And that's the key decision they're going to face.
Do you think that they have the control or the power to prop up the system, or do you think they now need the federal government to deficit spend as well? And I mean, kind of what I'm saying there is, has the Fed put expired and have we moved on to a government put?
Maybe. Ultimately, I think it kind of depends. Let me rephrase that. No, I don't think the Fed puts expired. And the reason I say that is I think the Fed can ultimately expand what they buy. And now, will that require some sort of emergency? Probably. But ultimately, I think you could see, while some would say, well, they need a, and I think by law, I think they are correct. They would tell you that the Fed needs a charter change to widen out what they buy. And I would defer to people like Danielle DiMartino Booth and Lacey Hunt on the legality of that. I always come back to the United States can't go to war without a declaration of war by the Congress. Yet we have not had such a declaration of war by the U.S. Congress since December 8th, 1941. Right. And we've had no problem having what we call police actions or conflicts or whatever the case might be.
Yeah, we have special purpose vehicles as well.
Special purpose vehicles, exactly. So it's, I think the real politic of the situation is that when the Fed needs to do something, they will. I think you could see, for example, a widening of collateral accepted at the standing repo facility window. So ultimately, the standing repo facility, what people should hear in their minds when they hear standing repo facility is continuing QE without calling it QE. That effectively, whatever the standing repo facility is eligible for is effectively the Fed continuing to buy those assets. So treasuries, mortgage backs, those are pretty standard types of collateral. The standing repo facility allows them to continue to supply liquidity to those markets and by virtue of those markets, the broader markets in total. But if they were to say, hey, we need to, we have a crisis and corporate debt is suddenly eligible at the standing repo facility. We know that they widened out to the corporate debt market last summer. So that's not even that big a leap. And ultimately, under Capital Structure 101, if the Fed's buying corporate debt, Fed's buying equities. It's a trickle down, right? It's corporate debt leads and equities follow. So I do think the Fed still has more to go or could do more. With that said, I agree, and that's why I kind of waffled at first. I agree 100% with the point that it's much more important that fiscal drives it from here on out. That is ultimately because the Fed can basically inject more and more liquidity. They can affect the economy through the wealth effect, through the impact on tax receipts, consumer spending as asset prices rise. But they're going to have a harder time doing two things. Number one, getting actual GDP growth in the real economy as directly. And number two, inflating the debt away in the way that they really need to do to get the debt to GDP to a level that they can normalize rates. And so that brings us back to the second question you had, George, which is inflation transitory? And my answer is it better not be. and so I think the answer is no. And the reason I say it better not be is, and this is something I find not that many sort of the bond bulls as a group on address. I don't know if they understand it or not. I don't want to put, but they never address it, which is given the way policymakers have allowed the system to evolve, the solvency of the bond market is now dependent on the inflation, not just of asset prices, but also CPI inflation. You need to basically, once you get debt to GDP to 130%, like the US is at, Hirschman Capital did some great work on this last summer. They pointed out if you go back 200 years, there have been 52 examples of nations hitting 130% debt to GDP over 200 years. And 51 of those 52 defaulted on the debt, most of them via a period of high rates of inflation. Right. And the one that didn't was Japan. And ultimately, there's a number of reasons that that hasn't happened. It's rarely mentioned that Japan is 180 degrees opposite of the situation of the U.S. Yet,
in what ways, Luke?
The U.S. runs Japan's a current account surplus nation. They have a massive net international investment position positive as a percent of GDP. So call it 60-70% of GDP. So they have foreign assets. They have run massive surpluses for decades, and then they've taken those surpluses and reinvested them in U.S. asset markets and other asset markets around the world. So in extremis, Japan has always, they haven't had to do QE. They have done it, but they always had the option of saying, you know what, U.S., we need to finance ourselves here. Give us our money back. Sell stocks, sell treasuries, sell real estate, sell it all to the tune of 70% of Japanese GDP. And so 70% of Japanese GDP say they want to grow GDP at 4%. They could do that for 4% times 70%. What is that? Just short of 20 years, 16 years, 17 years. So they could have done that, basically deploying accrued savings, accrued wealth, but they haven't. But they had an option. America has no such option. America has run twin deficits for a long time. And so the choice for the U.S. is either default or have the Fed print the difference when it comes time to do it. And so and the Fed's printed the difference. So there's geopolitical realities in there as well. I mean, the U.S. has a substantial military presence in Japan. And so it's not always just about, hey, what are the economic choices? There are also some military geopolitical choices for both the Japanese and the United States governments within that. So it's very different. And what's interesting is, despite the fact that 51 out of 52 times when you get to 130% of GDP, you've had the government default usually versus high inflation, that's 98%. In investment markets, 98% is like as good as it gets in terms of, you know.
It's like an inverted yield curve.
Yeah, right. It's like, hey, I want to give you an investment with a 98% chance of happening. And people say, oh my God, where do I sign up? And yet in this case, you have something with a 98% chance of happening over 200 years. And people say, no, 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 we're Japan. We're the 2% example. Even though, as I just said, we literally could not be more different than Japan. And now critically, the US is the global reserve currency, and there's a very valid point. And so that has both bought us time. It does make us different than Japan. It does make us different from a lot of those other 52 examples. You know who it doesn't make it different than? It doesn't make it different than the Brits in 1931. they were the global reserve currency then, and it didn't stop. It delayed the inevitable, but didn't stop the inevitable. And so ultimately, when you look at it through that lens, that's something a lot of the bond bulls I hear, not, you know, it's very much the debate of inflation is there's all this debt, and debt is deflationary. And so this inflation is just temporary. And yes, but the second part of that statement that the bond bulls rarely, if ever, disclose is, if that is to be true, when the debt problem is at the sovereign level, that what your bet, your investment thesis is based on the United States government deciding to shrink itself, deciding to slash defense, slash entitlements to boomers, slash interest payments to U.S. Treasury holders, and rates are already at zero. So yes, we could get deflation if for the first time in a sustained deflation, if for the first time in history, the U.S. government with a fiat currency decides to shrink itself and go into a severe austerity. And oh, by the way, if the U.S. did choose severe austerity, because the U.S. government is 30% of GDP, GDP would go negative. And as GDP goes negative,
that's just by the way, that's just the federal government.
Right.
That's just not all governments. It's all 50, 60.
Right. That's just the federal government. So even if the federal government goes into austerity, you're going to shrink GDP. When you shrink GDP, you're going to shrink tax receipts. When you shrink tax receipts, look, for much of last year, the U.S. government's tax receipts were below the combined total of entitlement pay as you go. It's just not the big bill, just what we were paying last year for entitlements and interest expense. When your tax receipts are below entitlements and interest expense, you have a choice: print the money or default on them. And that's why I say there's this dynamic to the deflationary angle that all, if we look at it simply in a narrow vacuum, yes, it's deflationary, but we have to ignore political realities to make that case. And my case has all along been and continues to be, there is zero chance the U.S. government in the midst of a new Cold War against China is going to slash defense spending by 50, 60, 70%, as implied by the deflation case. There is zero chance, in my view, that they are going to significantly cut entitlement payments to baby boomers. There is zero chance they are going to default on U.S. Treasury bond coupon payments to domestic or foreign creditors. And if those three things are zero chance, those three things are well over 100% of tax receipts. Sort of everything else is added then on top of that the federal government spends on. And so to me, I think it is very much akin to the 70s with a blend of, call it, 1931 Germany, without having the hangup of having hyperinflated 8 years prior, which is to say, U.S. government is in a bad trade position. We're running big deficits. We do have the reserve currency. That's a huge offset to that. And so it doesn't make it a perfect comparison by any stretch. Excuse me. The Germans in the 1931 had the same exact, had a very similar problem, which was, we have a massive debt. A lot of that debt was taken on for consumption and sort of stadiums, things that could not generate the foreign currency to pay back the loans. Now, the U.S.
and the Versailles Treaty, reparations,
These are separate reparations. They also had the reparations of the Versailles Treaty, which were also old in gold, a currency they couldn't print. And so the U.S. owes most of its debt in a currency it can print. And so then it's, okay, are they going to print a currency they can print to avoid default? And in my opinion, that's as close as you can get to a guarantee in the investment business. Yes, ultimately they will. We can debate about path, and I agree there are different paths and political realities around that path, but they're gonna do it, in my view. And so it's a structural inflationary view.
All right, so let me take the counter argument there so we can sift through. And I think you kind of answered these questions, but we'll get a little more specific. I think the two arguments you're gonna get, number one is, okay, that's great if the Fed wants to do that or the government wants to do that, but how do they get the dollars into the newly created dollars into the real economy, circulating with velocity, and therefore needing to get those dollars on the balance sheets of non-bank entities in the real economy? Because the Fed it gets a little sticky there. You know, they can print all the bank reserves denominated in dollars, but unless they're, you know, now if they're buying equities from entities in the real economy, then now you're creating new currency units that are circulating. Or I think that, you know, through my research, if the Fed's running a huge deficit and the government is running a huge deficit and the Fed is monetizing it, then those dollars are not being sucked out of the system to begin with, because those treasuries are purchased with newly printed bank reserves. Therefore, when the money is spent out of the TGA into the real economy, now all of a sudden on net balance, you've got an increase in the amount of dollars. I think that's probably why we saw M2 go up so dramatically in 2020. But what are your views on that? How do they get the dollars, you know, from the Fed? Or as Lacey Hunt would say, how do we turn bank reserves into legal tender?
I think there's one of two ways. One of which I think we just saw happen, which was exactly what you described, which was the Treasury spent a bunch of money and the Fed effectively monetized it. And mm-hmm. I think if you go back to August of 2019, former Fed Vice Chair Stan Fisher wrote a white paper for the BlackRock Institute with two other former central bankers and said, listen, in the next downturn, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have to go direct. We're going to have to, the government's going to run deficits and we're going to monetize it. And we saw that. And we are now seeing how that can absolutely generate inflation. You know, and interestingly, in that white paper, Fisher said, look, the problem is not can we generate inflation doing this? We absolutely can. He said, the problem is there's no examples in history of using this formula to just generate a little of inflation.
Right.
This is not a fine tool. You know, most often this results in very high inflation and in a lot of cases, hyperinflation. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be careful with this. And so I think that's way number one. So I think they've already done it. They proved it can work. We've seen in our, you know, we can say there's not that much inflation and it's who you're going to believe, the government or your own lying eyes. We're seeing inflation. The question then is again, I think one of politics of, do they want to continue it? And then I think the second way is when I hear central bank digital currency, the Fed wants to get central bank digital currency. And I keep hearing this over and over. What I hear in my head is this is how they're going to take the federal government's inability to do stuff out of the mix.
Exactly. Or the commercial banking system, because in the past, the commercial banking system creates the dollars. Now we have this hybrid system, but the Fed is still at the mercy, so to speak, of the government and the commercial banks. How do they get around that? Well, they just have a central bank digital currency, and that's how they turn those bank reserves into legal tender.
I think that's exactly what's going to happen. Just out of necessity, because again, once you get to this 130%, particularly given the structure of our system, deflation is simply not an option. You can have slight periods of it, but it is not an option unless you are willing to allow the federal government to default on either its defense obligations, its entitlement obligations, or its treasury obligations. Because if you have sustained deflation, the U.S. government will nominally default on one or all three in some of those obligations in some form or fashion.
Okay, so the second pushback you're going to get is the yield curve. They're going to look at the 10-year and they're going to say, Luke, you know, what are you talking about here? The 10 years at, I don't know what it is now, 1.4, 1.5, something like that. If what you're saying was true, we'd see the long end of the curve just completely skyrocket.
So that assumes the bond market's a market, which is sort of the first principle is if you assume the bond market's actually a real market and people say, well, we're Japan. I say, okay, let's talk about that. Japan, the 10-year market, that goes days without trading sometimes. Second biggest bond market in the world. So, you know, you can't have it both ways, right? We're either Japan or we're not. Now, I said we're not Japan. I don't think we're Japan. The bond market has been telling us this, though. And this is what I've said is, if you take a look at where the U.S. has issued, there's been this really interesting trend where, and we've talked about this before, George, where we have gone from 3Q14, foreign central banks are still buying treasuries, then on net they stop. So then we have global private sector, German and Japanese big pensions, they're financing U.S. treasuries or financing U.S. deficits. Okay, still a very good creditor. Then 3Q18, FX hedge treasury yields go negative. They stop buying as many and start looking other places because of basically the FX hedging costs turned U.S. treasuries into the lowest yielding sovereign amongst the big sovereigns on a currency hedged basis. Okay, so who finances the U.S. government next? It's highly levered hedge funds. Well, that worked for from 3Q18 through 3Q19 until the yield curve flattened and then went inverted. Well, then who finances it? It's the Fed. And what's interesting is throughout this whole time, we have seen, you know, in 3Q14, if you go back to the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee reports from 3Q14, what you see is a plan for the U.S. government to extend weighted average maturity of treasuries up and to the right over time. In other words, they're going to term out the debt to give themselves more financial flexibility. Mm-hmm. And instead, that flatlined and then has gone down. They did the opposite. And they've been issuing more and more debt in shorter and shorter term terms. Now, it's sort of like some say tomato, some say tomato. Those on so to answer the question directly, when we had a supply-demand problem, where did we see yields blow up? We saw them blow up at the front end of the curve, which is exactly where you would. They're not issuing that much at the long end. They can contain the long end with the QE they're doing and the amount of duration matching. If the U.S. government actually issued its $3 trillion in deficits at the 10-year, you would see the 10-year at some enormous number. You'd see the Fed buying it all. And then the Fed would be trapped because now they owe that. You know, the Fed had $3 trillion in 10-year debt every year for the next however many years. They could never sell that. That is absolute, outright, explicit monetization for the next 10 years. That has serious policy implications. If you issue it all at the short end, 3 months, 6 months, and they're doing 75-80% at less than a year, you can always say, well, we're not monetizing. This is just short term. Remember what they said about not QE. This is not QE because it's all at the short end of the curve. What happened to short rates when we had a supply-demand problem in 3Q19? They went to 8 to 10% in repo markets.
Yeah, what you're talking about is the repo spike. Just to be clear, you're talking about the
repo spike. We saw
48
hours of the real, yeah, we saw for 48 hours. And you saw how far the Fed went from a 18-month program of we're going to shrink our balance sheet, 48 hours, we're growing the balance sheet again.
Yeah,
they
and by buying the long end of the curve. We're not buying those T-bills anymore.
Well, doing a little bit of both, right? But that's so the people saying that rates didn't rise, they did rise. It's just, you know, it's like the phrase Phil Knight was quoted in, I think, 1997 or 1998. He said, everybody's looking for the next Michael Jordan on the basketball court, but he's walking up the fairway, right? Mm. So obviously referring to Tiger Woods. Right. And it's the same thing. Everyone's looking for this bond market blow up at the long end of the curve. It already happened at the short end of the curve. And the bond bulls will say, well, that was regulatory. And that was, and yes, it was regulatory. But again, you have to look back to why and all of a sudden, beginning in 3Q14, did the U.S. government start regulating banks and money market funds to buy all these treasuries? This is a classic playbook of an emerging. Argentina did this in 2000 when they lost their foreign financing. Who did they regulate into buying their domestic sovereign debt? The banks. Mm-hmm. Hey, we will give you a capital. You can use this as capital regulations, and we'll give you a discounted, you know, a capital reading with your regulators. And so, it's a little bit of what came first. You know, the chicken or the egg. Say, well, they're buying so much in treasuries because they have to, because they're regulated. My view, and I think the preponderance of the evidence suggests they were regulated to buy these because foreigners stopped buying enough of them for a number of different both economic and geopolitical reasons. And so that's what I would say is the bond market already blew up at the short end. And then everything else is—it's not really a market. I mean, we don't see a market. Have the Fed dump the balance sheet by Christmas? Let's have a market. Let's see. They'd probably trade like Evergrande bonds, you know.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Let's take it to an extreme. That always is a good thought experiment to try to understand what's actually happening.
Yeah, it informs the means, right?
Yeah, the thing that I always get caught up on is every time the Fed did QE, whether it's QE 1, 2, or 3, that yields on the long end actually went up. And I've talked to Snyder about that, and he is under the opinion that that's because the market expects inflation, and therefore they sell more than the Fed is buying. And then once they see that inflation isn't materializing, then they, they no longer buy, and then rates start to come down. I think we've seen the same thing in 2020 and 2021. What's your opinion of that?
I think it makes sense. I mean, it's what I would do. Ultimately, if the Fed's going to basically hand out free money, you sell your treasuries and you buy pretty much everything that's not treasuries, right? You buy, yeah. And so we've seen, you can also see it in the S&P over TLT ratio, right? So the ratio of the S&P 500 to the TLT, the long bond ETF, which in 2008 was, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but the bottom line is it's risen 5X from 2008 until now. Rates haven't moved a whole lot from 2000. I mean, I'm talking about it at the depths of the crisis. Rates haven't moved a whole lot, but the S&P is five times more valuable relative to treasury bonds that were yielding roughly the same thing then as now. And so but as you watch, it's the inverse of what Jeff just described, or what you described Jeff saying, which is, yeah, when QE starts, the S&P goes up, and then when it stops, it goes, and so it's
right,
been this.
Right, right, right.
So I think that makes sense. Now that I disagree with Jeff is they have to make inflation. You know, it was increasingly important for them to make inflation show up because they can't pay the debt in real terms. They can't pay positive rates. The closer you get to 100%, you can't pay positive real rates without going bankrupt. At 130%, it's a matter of national security to get inflation. They have to get that number down a lot relatively quickly.
Okay, cool. So let's go ahead and transition over to some bullet points you have on your website. So I want to encourage everyone to go over there. I'm reading this right off your site, and I think you've got a link to it on your Twitter feed. So follow Luke on Twitter, and it's pinned tweet. And then you've got a three-part video series where you share six charts that are the key as we head into 2021. So I won't go over the charts because I want everyone to go to your website and check it out. But let's just go over those bullet points. And we probably touched on some of these here, but I think it'll be interesting to address them in order. So the first thing is, over the past 120 years, sovereign debt levels as high as advanced economies' debts currently are or have been resolved in three ways. So we were talking about that. You got default restructuring, inflation, or hyperinflation. One thing that I'd like you to maybe expand on there, and I think I originally got this chart from you, so thank you very much, and I use it constantly, and that is the chart of the German mark relative to marks backed by gold, and therefore basically the mark versus gold from 1920 to roughly 1922, that the mark actually appreciated in value against gold, and I believe the dollar as well.
Gold outperformed massively. Gold outperformed massively.
No. The German mark did. The mark appreciated in value against gold from roughly. There's about a year and a half time span from 1920 to roughly 1922, and that was basically a year and a half later. The mark is toilet paper.
Right. Oh yeah. No, that chart. Yeah. It shows basically the immense volatility.
Yeah. Like a year, but a year that preceded that,
yep.
Preceded that massive hyperinflation in 1923, the mark actually appreciated in value just slightly, against gold. So it shows you how quickly, things can change if you have all of that, excess money printing, let's say, that's been happening for years and years and years, in this case, since 1914. And so I think the point there, the takeaway, is that a lot of people see the dollar really not moving right now in the DXY, but they don't realize that if the seeds have been sown, that can be extremely explosive, that inflation.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that chart, all credit for that goes to Dan Oliver at Myrmecan Capital. It's his chart. He wrote a letter about that or that included that. So I want to make sure to give him full credit for that because it's a great chart. And these six charts we put on our website in January of this year. So coming into the year, and they've aged pretty well. I was looking at them the other day, and yeah, this chart shows the behavior of the German mark against gold during the German hyperinflation in the early 20s. And it's, to your point, it's really two things are really grabbing. Number one is if you held gold on a levered basis, you lost all your money
four or five
different times because like
that
you said,
was during the 1923 period. Yeah.
Yeah. The mark appreciated. There were times when the politicians came out and said, okay, we're going to act to stabilize the mark. And everyone, it went the other way. For a period of time. Now, it's amazing how much that chart looks like the chart of Bitcoin in dollars, or any of these cryptos in dollars. Or, you know, it's people always say, "Oh, crypto so volatile." crypto is just crypto. The Bitcoin's, it's a fixed supply. You know, real estate, we're seeing real estate rise at the fastest rate in 40 years, home prices. And it's one of these things where people are, generals always fight the last war, right? The old saying, everyone's waiting for the shoe to drop on real estate. But the thing that's grabbed me that people just aren't, I think, appreciating enough is in 05, 06, what was driving that was a supply of private credit. That was bank credit, that was subprime credit, that was the asset-backed market. There was private credit, private capital at risk backing that. What we're seeing drive prices now is the U.S. governments and Western sovereign governments and even Asia, you know, China more broadly. This sovereign bubble, they need to keep the sovereign debt price elevated, rates low, as a matter of national security, and they can never run out of capital. Like the aha moment I think most investors have not hit is what if this is the home price bubble you never sell? What if, because again, if home prices crash again like they did in 05, you're assuming the supply of capital has dried up, but the supply of capital—
And therefore, and potentially rates have gone up. Yeah, but they can't raise rates.
They can't raise rates. And it's the supply of capital is infinite because it's coming from a printing press. It's not coming from a private source that is at risk of losing any money. And yeah,
especially if we go to central bank digital currency and the Fed starts issuing mortgages directly.
Yeah. And even from a political standpoint, I mean, you can see the shift in Washington. I mean, generals always fight the last war. These politicians in Washington are convinced that deficits don't matter. Mm-hmm. Now, in the short run, they don't. But in the long run, again, they have mattered 100% of the time for 10,000 years of recorded human history. So the amount of hubris and exceptionalism to say they don't matter for the United States now, just because they haven't mattered for the past 50 years because of how the system is structured, is extraordinary, because 50 years is a long time for you and me, but in history, it's a blink of an eye. Like this stuff always ends the same way. So, you know, the question is, of course, when does it end? We've gone through this process where sovereign debt is, it is now a matter of national security that the sovereign debt market be priced improperly, that the sovereign debt market be priced at an increasingly negative real interest rate.
Yeah, why don't you unpack that a little bit, Luke? I've followed you, and I totally get what you're saying. But for some of the viewers who might not have heard you or any of your ideas before, can you kind of unpack why that's a matter of national security?
Sure. So the easiest way to think about it is if you're running debt to GDP at 130%, you need to get that back. Basically, you got to get that back down to a normalized level, so you can, or to a lower level, so that you can raise interest rates without choking off your own government, without choking off your own economy, because debt levels are so high. Historically, the way you do that is by having negative real interest rates. So you let inflation run a little higher than the rate of interest you're paying on the bonds. And as that happens, you have GDP growth rise and nominal GDP growth rises, and bondholders lose some purchasing power. And after a stretch of 5 or 10 years of doing that, your debt to GDP is down to a normalized level. You can raise rates and kind of go back to it.
1940s.
The 1940s, right? So you saw U.S. debt to GDP go from 110% to 55% in 5 years, and U.S. real interest rates, in other words, the amount that it was interest rate minus inflation at the lows, were at negative 14%. So in 1 year after, you know, I think 46 or 47, U.S. bondholders lost 14% of their purchasing power in a single year relative to inflation. That's historically how this has worked out. Now, the United States in 1946 to 47, they were the world's biggest creditor. Mm-hmm. So when you're a creditor and you run negative real interest, it's easy to run negative real interest rates and without disrupting capital flows. And that's the other thing. So we were a massive creditor, and you had restricted capital flows. You had capital controls around the world. So capital couldn't run from this repression. It had nowhere to go.
Right,
and gold
was
illegal for Americans to own.
Right. Good point.
So the challenge is that when you're a twin deficit nation like the US, if you run and you're foreign financed, when you run significantly negative real interest rates, you're basically stealing purchasing power from your foreign creditors. That's a great situation for us. It's hurting them, helping us. And we've been doing this for a long period of time, a little by little. I would equate it to when your kid has a drug habit and your kid breaks into the neighbor's house and steals their jewelry, hawks it. Like, that's great because, you know what? My wealth, my standard of living is going up. The kid can have his drug habit. It doesn't matter. He's stealing from the neighbors. That's making the neighbor poor. It's not making me poor. That's the U.S. runs twin deficits, and foreigners finance those twin deficits at a negative real rate situation. If you do what we've been increasingly doing since 3Q14, when foreign central banks stopped growing their holdings of treasuries on net, and then after 3Q18, when the global private sector stopped buying as much, right, now you have a twin deficit that has gotten much bigger and that is increasingly being financed by the domestic sector. And so this is like your kid having a drug habit and stealing your shit and selling it. Now your kid's drug habit's making you poorer. And so what negative real rates does to an economy when the government's deficits are being financed by the domestic private sector amounts to a tax increase. They're basically increasing taxes on U.S. bondholders to pay for the government's deficits. And so the economy shrinks over time, the government grows over time, and you end up with what is effectively a state-run, the government's a massive percent of GDP. And yep. Guess what we're seeing? We're seeing exactly that happen.
And if the economy shrinks, the tax receipts go down. Therefore, they can't afford to pay for the military. Therefore, that's how it's a matter of security, national security.
They can't pay that. They can't pay. I mean, we're already seeing social unrest at the highest levels in 50 years in the last 2 years. Can you imagine
right.
what would happen if they start cutting entitlements?
It
just, it can't happen. So that is the challenge. And so it is why we're different now than we were after World War II. And oh, by the way, there's the everybody loves the dollar as a weapon, free flow of capital. We will just, you know, we'll raise rates and we'll suck all that capital back over here, right? We'll dollar milkshake the world. Brent's right. We could do that. The challenge is it's a two-edged sword. And because we deployed that weapon too much, the capital's all here. And one of the conditions to the post-71 dollars, you have to have a free flow of capital. And if you start financially repressing it, remember we talked about earlier on, Japan has 60 to 70% positive net international investment position as a percent of GDP. You start screwing the Japanese out of the real wealth, they'll go, you know what, forget it. We're going to bring it home and we're going to go redeploy it into where we're getting paid a higher rate. And so what does that look like? It looks like Chinese bond market getting $120 billion of inflows last year. Now, that might not have been the right thing to do, given some of what we're seeing with Evergrande, some of these other things. But the issue is that there is actually a free flow of capital. You can only financially repress that capital for so far before it escapes, unless you want to put capital controls in. And that's fine. You put capital controls in, though, and the dollar status post-71 is over. That's a change in structure. So it's the Fed's really kind of trapped in this box. The U.S. government's really kind of trapped in this box that they created. It was a great system. And, you know, it's sort of gone too far. The success of the system has sown the seeds of its own destruction.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Okay, cool. So I'm going to go down to the next bullet point where we've talked about that. I just want to highlight it really quick. And it seems likely the Fed finance stimulus is coming no matter who controls the White House or Congress. And we've been talking about this the whole time, how this is not a Democrat or Republican thing. They're going to get to a point where they just don't have a choice, regardless of whether they're blue or red or any of that stuff. And I'd be fascinated to see the charts on those as well. So the political nature of what is likely to transpire means volatility is likely to remain elevated. So are you talking about volatility in the stock market?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So how is that going to be directly correlated to volatility in the stock market?
Ultimately, I think it comes down, I think we're seeing an episode of it coming right up now, right? Where we, to make the debt sustainable, you need to have nominal GDP growth run at multiples well above the interest rate you're paying on the debt, right? So we went from 130% debt to GDP to 125% of GDP last quarter when we had GDP run 6 to 6.5 and the rate on the debt was 1. So that was that worked. Challenges is that just doing that for one quarter, you can see the supply chain problems we're already having. We probably need to do that for another 5 years. Can you imagine what inflation would be like if we did this for another 5 years? And that's just with inflation at 6. What if it was a 10 or 15? And that then gets back to the challenge of you need the bond market to basically, you know, stay still and allow us to repress the heck out of it while you do that. The volatility comes in because it's so political. It's such a political, right? We're going to do it. We're going to do it. And then Joe Manchin says, nope, we're not going to do it. I'm not going to spend the money. Well, if we don't spend the money, or if the Republicans say we're not going to raise the debt ceiling, I think you're going to have periods of very high volatility. I don't think they'll last for very long because, you know,
they'll have to submit.
Everyone's a deficit hawk until their 401k goes down, you know, or until, you know, Nancy Pelosi's call options expire worthless a couple times in a row. And in all seriousness, they've allowed the system to evolve that the wealth effect is a key driver to consumer spending. It's a key driver to tax receipts. And as a result, they cannot let stocks fall too far for too long. And so that's where that volatility comes from. It's just that political nature of I'm going to take a stand against deficits and, you know, we're going to take a stand against the debt ceiling and, you know, they'll fold. They'll have to fold. But in the meantime, that probably will elevate volatility.
Yeah, I had a tweet yesterday that I sent out and I said, it seems to me like we've moved from the business cycle to the government deficit cycle. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much what matters now. You know, it's like the business cycle's dead.
it's exactly what matters. And this is when you read the history books, the thing the Fed has done a marvelous job of is extending the cycle. And they've done it the number of different ways, the expansion of paper derivatives. I mean, it was, you know, interest rate derivatives, right? They took out the bond market vigilantes. So once you had interest rate derivatives, who needs to sell bonds? You can just, you know, buy interest rate derivatives. And then that sort of blew up spectacularly in 08 because no one knew who owned what and what have you. But the Fed has done a marvelous job of extending this cycle of what was always going to happen. You know, once you set up a fiat currency, 100% of them have always ended the same way. I mean, there is no fiat currency that has lived throughout history on a long enough time frame. The question was always a time frame. And so the Fed's done a marvelous job of extending it. But ultimately, that's where we are. We're in that part of the cycle where you're right. There is not, is a great way of phrasing it, in my opinion, which is there isn't a business cycle. There's a government spending cycle. The government's number one mandate is don't let the government shut down. And they have a printing press that never runs out of money. And so when you sort of put those factors together, you go, that's how high inflation, those are how the real high inflation start. It's not, you know, oops, too much money and the business cycle was too strong. No, the real monumental inflations that have happened throughout history have come from a government with a fiat currency and a bad debt problem and an inability or unwillingness to shrink itself to address that problem. And that's where the United States is.
Yeah, exactly. All right. We've already touched it, but just for the viewers, because I want to encourage them to go to your website and get these charts. I'll just go over the next couple bullet points here. U.S. fiscal situation worse now than in World War II. And by comparison, U.S. real rates were -14%. Wow. I didn't realize that. Arguably, the biggest misconception in markets is that U.S. real rates have bottomed at -1.1%. Yeah, that's exactly goes back to what we're talking about. So, Luke, what on earth, if all this inflation is going to happen, negative real rates, what on earth is going on with gold?
What indeed. It's been just So there's, I think maybe the one of the more interesting things we've seen as it relates to the gold market has been this net stable funding ratio change that began to go into effect in June under Basel III, the global banking regulations. And what it effectively says is that it is effectively appears to be a wind down of the paper gold, the unallocated paper gold market on some level. And so the US and Europe already, it went live at the end of June. The UK appears to have gotten a stay of or a loophole, but it's still set to go live in London, which is, of course, the center of global unallocated gold market activity. And unallocated gold just means that it's over the counter, and there are effectively an unlimited number of paper claims
Which is the
on.
futures market.
Well, the futures market at least has an offset, right? I mean, it is that market has also gotten less allocated. It's not exactly the right term to use, but you can, for example, I had one of the biggest gold traders in the world tell me a couple of years ago, look, when I started trading gold futures 20 years ago, probably 10 to 15% of the gold futures traded on the COMEX on any given day was either had an underlying gold ounce or was related to an underlying physical gold ounce. And that number is now 1 to 2%, and volume in the meantime has risen like 4x. So there's the implied leverage on COMEX has risen meaningfully, where it's become a much more paper market. But the real that's really much more of a sideshow relative to London, which is the ability, it's just gold credit, right? It is just, hey, I want to buy $100 million in gold. Well, as of 3, 4, or 5 months ago, I heard buying $100 million in physical gold would probably take you 3 to 4 months to source. You want to buy $100 million in credit gold, if you're a big fund, you can call up, big bank, big bullion bank in London, say, I want 100 million in gold. Boom, they can have you done instantly. That's credit gold. And there'll be some sort of offsetting.
So they're just giving them a receipt saying we owe you 100 million in gold
Yes, effectively.
as a fractional reserve gold.
The fractionally reserved gold. And so what I think has happened, to answer your question, is I think we have seen for years now this fractionally reserved gold system be allowed to expand to prevent either to prevent gold prices from rising, or if you look at what we've seen over the last 7 or 8 years, coincident with foreign central banks stopping to buy treasuries, foreign central banks beginning to buy a lot of gold. And so to me, there's one of two possible interpretations. One, to just hold gold down so that, basically if there's more demand for gold, one of two things can go up: the price of gold or the amount of claims on the underlying gold. That's those are the only and the release valve has been the number of claims on underlying gold. The other interpretation of that is the reason the claims have been allowed to rise on gold is so that the gold can move to where it's needed to be before some sort of systemic reset. In other words, they don't want, if historically the way these sovereign debt problems have worked out have been by devaluing fiat currencies in aggregate against something else on central bank balance sheets, the only thing on central bank balance sheets that could serve that is gold. And so if you're going to do that, if that becomes inevitable, as what we just discussed suggests, it is now inevitable. We're at the 130% debt to GDP on the reserve currency that underpins all other currencies. It is inevitable. We can say, okay, is it going to happen next week? Is it going to happen in 5 years, 10 years? I don't know, but it's inevitable. Mathematically, 98% of the time for the past 200 years, and we've gotten here, this is how it goes. So you could make the case, I think, that the reason that they've allowed paper to expand to keep gold from rising, despite everything we're seeing, has been they need the gold to move to where it's supposed to be before some sort of systemic reset. Because again, gold is a very political market. It is not some free market. It is a political metal. And so if you're going to reset the system using gold, it's not like the US can just say, well, we're going to buy it all and then we're going to control you all again. That's not how it's going to go. The US has to have some, the Chinese have to have some, the Russians have to have some, the Europeans have to have some, the Japanese have to have some. It has to be sort of proportionately, it's not like they're going to allow three hedge funds to buy up all the gold ahead of the central banks doing that. That's not the type of market it is. So conspiratorial, yes, possibly. But I think that the direct answer is I think the reason why it hasn't done anything is you've seen the expansion in paper derivatives. I mean, and it, the reason that makes sense is look at everything else. So you tell me everything else that has a finite supply, houses, used cars,
yeah,
Bitcoin,
right.
Everything else with a somewhat finite supply is at 30, 40-year highs, all-time highs, and gold's not. With all that central bank buying, with all that Asian buying, with all that other buying, maybe,
right.
But it doesn't pass the smell test, right? And so, you know, to me, the conclusion as it relates to gold is not, hey, gold's useless, you should sell it all. I think the conclusion is I don't think gold's going to do anything, and then I think gold's going to do what it's supposed to do in a very compressed time period. You know, you go home on a Friday, it's 1800, you come in on Sunday night and it's 5,000, and you were either there or you won't. And oh, by the way, it's physical only. You know, if you own paper claims, you're going to get cash settled at the Friday 1800. And if you didn't own physical, sorry, you know, that you always knew the name of the, you always knew the market. If you didn't know the market, you should have known the market. That's your fault, not theirs. So I increasingly think the lack of movement in gold, particularly when everything else has moved the way it has, to me, my conclusion, it actually makes me feel, I mean, it doesn't make me feel good, but it makes me feel increasingly confident that that gold is likely to resolve on the upside in some sort of reset in a very compressed time frame.
That makes a lot of sense. That reminds me of how Chris Cole views volatility, you know, that you can't destroy it. You can only contain it for so long before it's going to come out, and then all the volatility that you suppressed for the last 2 or 3 years, you're going to see it happen in weeks, if not days.
Well, that's exactly right. So all these fiscal problems we've talked about, a way you could do this, and we wrote about this earlier this year, is if the Treasury orders to the Fed to revalue the gold on the U.S.'s balance sheet. Every, I don't know, we have 260 million ounces in theory, assuming that's all there. Every 4,000 bucks is $1 trillion, I think, right? And that money, it's just an accounting entry. If they tell them, so every 4,000 bucks is $1 trillion in the TGA, that it is just a free kitty for Treasury to spend. So if we wanted to do this, literally, they could say, hey, make it 40,000 bucks. Gold's 40,000 bucks an ounce, physical only. There's $10 trillion into the TGA, and they are going to spend it immediately on whatever, infrastructure, reshoring, you know, something productive, hopefully. But that's the type of thing where, again, it's the exact what Chris Cole's talking about is that gold is worth 40,000 now. You can see the debt, right? We know at some point that debt has to get written down, likely against gold. We know what the debt's doing. We know the debt's unrepayable. And so at that point, it's just, you know, Americans won't buy something that's not going up in price culturally. And if gold's just sitting there, we won't own it. We won't be patient. We mark our assets to market monthly. But you know, the fiscal situation for the US, for the world, for Western sovereigns, for China, all of it are getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. You see all these central banks buying all this gold. You see the world's biggest oil producer and energy producer buying gold in Russia. You know, you see the U.S. having a fallout with Saudi. All the signs are there. I mean, so it's, you know, if you came to me and said, Luke, it is, you know, next Monday, gold's $40,000 an ounce. I'd be like, I knew it was going to happen someday. I didn't know then. Now, if we go 10 years from now and gold is still friggin' 1800 bucks, maybe 10 years, I'd be a little surprised. But at 5 years from now, if gold's still 18 and they've 1800 and they've managed to muddle this thing along for another 5 years, which I think is a stretch, but in theory, that wouldn't surprise me either. So it's
yeah, but then, but then it doesn't go to 5,000 overnight. It goes to 10,000 overnight,
right?
Or it adjusts to whatever level.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Because the underlying stress is still rising. That volatility is being transmuted, and it's going to keep being transmuted until it stops being transmuted. And we're all going to know when it stops.
Yeah. Okay. So I know we're probably running short on time here, but I've got two super important questions, very topical, and I want to get your macro view on them. First and foremost is Afghanistan. And, you know, I don't want to talk about kind of the whether or not that was a good thing or a bad thing, or if it was done improperly. We'll leave that to others to debate, but it is what it is. So do you think that's going to have some macroeconomic consequences? When I saw that, as an example, when I first saw that, I said, wow, if I basically have an agreement with the United States government for my protection, and in return, I'm going to price my oil in dollars, all of a sudden, I don't feel too good about that relationship. So what are your views on that?
I think your line of thinking makes a lot of sense. And I tend to agree with it. The thing with the Afghanistan situation that has me asking questions that there aren't a lot of great answers to, have centered around two things. So I have a friend of mine who's a former senior military officer who served over in Iraq. And I think he was in Afghanistan as well, served for a long time. And he, shortly after that whole thing went down, he sent me this great article from another former officer laying out what went wrong. And some of it is just sort of standard bureaucratic stuff. But then shortly thereafter, I had an investing graybeard who's worked with a number of legends and has been, I mean, I think he's a legend himself. No one would probably know his name as a household name, but he's brilliant. But at any rate, he's a friend of mine. And he sent me this fascinating interview of Lara Logan. It was actually Tucker Carlson who did the interview, which I know would probably turn off some people, but it was actually a really good interview. So Lara Logan made the same points as this military officer on the blog that my friend sent me, the military officer friend sent me, a number of the same points, which were the U.S. intelligence establishment knew where the Taliban was. It was preposterous to think that they were surprised at what was happening. There was like only one road in and out. We have satellites covering the place. We knew what's coming, who's coming. What's more, we've known for a long time that the Pakistani government has been funding the Taliban for a long time, back to like 30 years ago. We've known that. The United States government, I didn't realize this, Logan made the point that the United States government gives the Pakistani intelligence services like $3 or $4 billion a year.
Wow.
And they're supporting the Taliban, and we knew they were coming. And so you go and you say, okay, so we know they're coming, but we act like we don't. We have the ability to shut off, right? This dollar system, this dollar system that we can weaponize, that we have weaponized over and over and over. And you hear all the dollar bulls say, you know, we can weaponize this anytime we want. And I agree. I'm the first person to agree. Why didn't we stop remittances out of the United States to Pakistan? It's very easy to do. Go to the SWIFT, shut it off. Why are we giving $3 to $4 billion a year to the Pakistani intelligence services when they're supporting the Taliban? If the story as we're told is true.
Right.
And so the only conclusion you come to is that there's something we're not being told. And there's something very big and foundational first principle about this whole setup that we're not being told. And once you sort of come to that conclusion, and I'm not going to speculate as to who, what, where, why, other than when I have one narrative put in my head by sort of every mainstream news channel, and then another narrative put in, and then you can sort of, you know, people that were there, et cetera, just making the point that that narrative doesn't make sense for reason A, B, C, D, E, and F, and so on. There's something else going on. And so then, you know, what is that something else going on? Is there some sort of organized pullout? Is there some sort, are we, you know, is this a way to cut expenditures vis-a-vis the fiscal situation? Is this just a domestic political promise the Biden administration felt like they made and just did a messy job of executing it on the way out? I don't know. But when you look at it both through that angle and then overlay that angle with your point, which I think is very valid, is it can't make you feel really good if you're the Saudis.
Yeah, right.
And then lo and behold, a week later, what do we see? We see the Saudis and the Russians signing a defense deal, a defense cooperation deal. And I think this adds to the intrigue is the Saudi minister, defense minister, specifically said we were impressed with the performance of Russian weapons in Syria. Now, who were the Russian weapons fighting in Syria? They're fighting American weapons. It might not have been wielded by us, but they were fighting American weapons. That's interesting. Why didn't we hear anything about that? You heard rumblings about it, this and that, and you saw some signs that maybe the Russian weapons were doing really well, or there was something that caught us by surprise in terms of Russian capabilities. But I think ultimately the big picture takeaway of Afghanistan is, I think, exactly what you laid out, which is, I think it will look back as sort of a big quickening of a major world change, particularly vis-a-vis what we saw in Syria, and then this defense cooperation agreement that was just signed between the Russians and the Saudis.
Potential with the petrodollar.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the Saudis are going to move to the Russian. I think they're moving to the Russian model, which is they'll sell oil in yuan, they'll sell, sell oil in euro. And what are they going to settle in? I think they're going to settle in gold.
Okay, so if that wasn't enough of a lightning rod, the last question here is, Biden just came out with his, I got to keep this very YouTube friendly here. You know,
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. So he comes out with these, let's say, restrictions on businesses that have over 100 employees. And I don't want to go into whether or not that was good or bad or anything. Everyone's got their view. But the bottom line is that's going to have, if that goes through, that's going to have some significant economic and macro consequences for the U.S. economy. So what do you think those consequences are? My guess would be that's probably fewer goods and services, therefore higher inflation.
Yeah, I think it's very stagflationary if it goes
through.
I think that, and I said this to someone a few weeks ago, because we started hearing about something that we've been writing about for about the last 3 or 4 weeks, which is called the Great Resignation. We talked to a registered investment advisor with a national financial firm, said they were getting, this was 3-4 weeks ago, they were getting so many inbound calls from clients about requirements restrictions that their employers were putting on prior to the announcement last week from Biden, that they wanted to prepare their financial picture. They were going to quit rather. And it was, like I said, they were getting so many of these inbounds that they actually came up with the name, the Great Resignation. You saw more of this as it related to the hospital and senior citizen or nursing home requirements as well. I think the coastal establishments are misreading this every bit as badly as they misread the 2016 Trump election, and every bit as badly as they misread the 2016 Brexit issue. I don't think they realize the percentage of people that are willing to go to the mattresses on this. And by go to the mattresses, I mean walk away from their careers and go do something else.
All right.
And so, yeah, look, it ultimately comes down to, will people do it? Will they not? But if they do, it's going to be really interesting. It's going to be, I think, very stagflationary. I think you'll see a negative impact on employment. I think you'll see higher constrictions on goods and services, like you said, which is going to drive costs up. I think it'll drive supply chains to break down even faster than they're already being stretched for the reasons they're being stretched. And I think you could also have a problem in credit markets, right? Because now you're talking about people that have houses, they have cars, they have whatever. You may start to see delinquencies tick up. And now what are you going to do? It raises some interesting economic and political questions.
And wages, wouldn't wages just, I mean, if you're, I'm just trying to think, if I'm a business owner and I, employ those policies, let's say, and 25% of my workforce just up and quits, what do you do? And we're already at a point right now, correct me if I'm wrong, but where job openings are at all-time highs, like 11 million roughly, I think it was 10.9, something like that, but almost 11 million job openings right now. So the labor market is unbelievably tight. And then you throw this fuel onto the fire. But then are the margins there? I mean, are the margins there to increase the wages in the first place? And it's just this, it seems as though this just the distortions that this that these policies could have on the economy, they just don't end well. But to, I guess, to your point, they end in stagflation.
I think they're pretty stagflationary. Because I think it's very disruptive. I mean, if given just the underlying structure of the economy before this, he'd be hard pressed to come up with a policy that was worse in terms of making the problem worse.
Yeah, right.
You're already seeing stagflation.
Yeah.
If they came to me and said, "Luke, I want you to come up with a policy that'll make the stagflation worse for us," this would have been right at the top of the list.
Yeah, right.
So I just don't, you go back to that, I can't decide if it's, if the world's being run by idiots or by, smart people that are putting us on, or if they're actually idiots. And it's couldn't be more apropos in this case. And that's not a critique of one side of the aisle or the other. I feel like you said, being in Cleveland, being in the Rust Belt of America, I haven't felt it hasn't been as obvious to me that the coasts are as out of touch with what's going on in terms of these restrictions as they've been on anything since Trump got elected, when they were all shocked to death that he got elected.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right, Luke, I sure appreciate your time, man. That was an awesome conversation. So, for all of my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Absolutely. So obviously, like you mentioned, I do have an active Twitter feed at Luke Groman, LukeGroMen. You can also find us online at fftt-llc.com for updates on what we're up to. And we do have a promotion going on now on our Tree Rings product, which is really popular. It's fftt-treerings.com.
Absolutely. And I think I might even be an affiliate.
You are.
So,
You are.
okay, cool. So we'll put the affiliate link right in the description below.
Perfect.
And then on the website, that's where they can go and get the six charts where we went over those bullet
Yep.
points, basically the charts that you think are key to understanding 2021. So make sure you go to Luke's website and check those out. All right, my friend, thank you again. And I can't wait to have a conversation soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on again, George. It's great catching up.
Hi guys, I'd like to invite each and every one of you to the next Rebel Capitalist Live event. If you are a fan of the Rebel Capitalist show, I guarantee you will love the live event. The next one is Houston, where you can meet and listen to speakers, all your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist show. People such as Dr. Ron Paul, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, just to name a few. If you want to check out the rest of the speaker list and find out how you can attend, we'll put a link in the description below, or you can just go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. This is an event where you can learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out of control central banks and big governments. But it's not just about building wealth. It's about increasing your freedom and networking with like-minded individuals, fellow rebel capitalists. It's an amazing event. I know you'll absolutely love it. Check out rebelcapitalistlive.com, and I will see you in Houston.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.